Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, IATSE reached an agreement. Dune is here, so we have our reviews, spoiler-free and spoiler-filled, and Denis Villeneuve is our guest.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 187 of Real Blend, a podcast that wonders if, Kevin, can you tell me Denis Villeneuve's all-time favorite Josh Brolin movie?
Oh, no.
Kev, Denis Villeneuve...
Wait,
hold on. They've worked together for a long time. It's not one of their collaborations.
I know.
It's...
Doonies.
Yes!
Thank you.
We are symbiotic. I love it.
That was actually pretty damn good. I'm not gonna lie.
On this week's show, IATSE has reached an agreement with producers to prevent a strike. Dune is here, and director Denis Villeneuve. I can't believe I can say that. Director Denis Villeneuve joins the show. That is not a typo. He is our guest on the show. Let me introduce the guys first, starting with Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, Jake. I love that shirt on you, Jake.
Oh, thank you. You should watch the show on YouTube if you want to see it.
We're going to get to that in a second.
I want to flashback very quickly before we introduce the other handsome person on this show. Oof. And remember at the beginning of 2020 when we did our 100th episode live recording, I said that my most anticipated film of the year was Dune, but I said that there's another film that I cannot wait to see coming out with Tom Hanks and a dog called Bios.
That's true.
It's a big week for me.
This is a big week for you, but you don't want to say out loud what's going on.
Well, I can say that I've seen, well, I haven't seen Bios, but I've seen a film called Finch.
Yes. Which is also known as, what is it? Castaway meets Borat? We'll explain more on that.
I'm going to punch you in the face.
The other guy is Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C.
Look how handsome he is.
He does look really
nice. He's junket ready.
Sean, Jacob, Gabriel, good to see you guys as always. Doonies was... That's your mask. That's your masterpiece.
Doonies. Yeah. as soon as I thought it, I realized.
I picture you like in Man on Fire, like Sean walking away from a car on fire and Kevin just going, he's about to paint his masterpiece. And you just see Doonies floating across the screen.
We want to get into housekeeping, and Gabriel has some announcements to make. Gabe, why don't you kick us off?
Yes. So as Blenders may have noticed, we have a new release schedule, and now we can officially sort of announce that we're going to be consistent with it moving forward. On Friday mornings, we will be launching every episode of Real Blend.
Yay!
Real Blend Premium will still be on Mondays, and if we ever have bonus episodes, as you know we do every once in a while, those will be on Wednesdays. They will drop in the morning.
Oh, that's cool.
On each of those days. Yeah, so moving forward, when you want to listen to Real Blend, it will drop Friday mornings consistently.
And if you're a premium subscriber, that means you potentially could get 3 episodes of us a week.
This is true. And with that announcement,
it's
I want to say...
it's a little too much.
Keep an eye out in the main show for some new content, some new things that we might try. Now that we have this sort of more consistent release schedule, there's some more things we can plan for and have fun with coming out on Fridays, which is when movies are released.
Like Dune.
More on that this week. We are going to be doing a spoiler review of Dune.
If you want to get some access to Ribble and Premium, to get an ad-free version of the show and a newsletter from me, which I think this is a newsletter week, go to cinemablend.com/RealBlendPremium. Because we have some really fun shows on that one as well, too. And now you have an access to like an entire library of them.
Yeah. What are we, 60-plus episodes into Premium now?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And this was episode 187.
I've got to say, some of the hardest I've laughed in the history of us together is on the Premium episodes. Just because we kind of just let loose.
It is true. That is a really fun one. I want to bring some of the games from that into the main show.
Tom Honks.
Because... Yeah, that is a good one. All right, let's get to the poll. So Ridley Scott had a movie coming out this past week. Last week Ridley Scott had a movie coming out. And we all raved about it and told you guys to go see it. And not a lot of people listened to us. What did it make? Did anyone have the figure?
Under five. It was like 4 point something.
4.5 or something. Yeah,
it's not good. So we asked you guys, why didn't you go see The Last Duel? And we gave you a couple of options. Kev, here are the options I gave the people, and I want you to tell me which one that you think they chose. Right? I know. Maybe they're all waiting for Gucci. The choices were, it looked boring. I'm not going into a theater just yet. Meaning you don't feel comfortable going yet. I'll see it eventually. Oh, I did. Last one is waiting for Gucci. There you go. So which one do you think the people went with?
It's interesting because I'm trying to figure out the audience for The Last Duel, because one of the arguments we made last week in terms of No Time to Die was the idea that it's skewed older, right? And yeah, the idea that like Shang-Chi and Free Guy and all these films that maybe skew a little younger and Venom 2 are just crushing at the box office. So Last Duel is interesting to me because, one, I would argue leading up to The Last Duel, there wasn't a lot of talk about it, right? I don't remember there being a lot of conversation surrounding it until maybe like a week or two prior. To be honest with you, I think it's the, what was the first option?
Looked boring. Looked boring is the first one. And then not going into a theater was second. I'll see it eventually, and then waiting for Gucci.
I don't think it's waiting for, I'm going to say it's looks boring.
Yeah. Well, it looks boring got 27%.
Okay.
But I'll see it eventually got 57%. Did pretty well.
Everyone I tell about this movie says, oh, that sounds good. And then whenever I followed up this week, they're like, oh, no, I didn't go see it. But like, it sounded good when he talked about it. So sure.
It's really great. And I hope people find it. And Jake, I know you tweeted about this as well. The idea that like, box office doesn't mean the movie itself is not great. I mean, the film is last week was a perfect example of box office not meaning quality. Mm-hmm. Halloween Kills was not a great film. It was a pretty bad film, I thought, in terms of just in general and in terms of story and performance and acting and just screenwriting. It just didn't flow right. And it was kind of a middle film that had no, you know, meaning because we're waiting for the third one. But at the same time, that movie was made, what, $56 million or whatever it was. And it made
and
that money.
And it was available on Peacock.
Right. It made on the same and the same weekend it was released on streaming.
More people died in Halloween Kills than subscribed to Peacock.
Sean, I think pronounced it wrong. I think it's Peacock because you're not really sure if it exists. Peacock? It was on Peacock?
The only reason we have Peacock is because Brendan is a huge fan of The Office. And when they took The Office off of Netflix, we got
you
him
should bring him to Chicago.
Wait, why? Oh, for that display?
They've recreated the set.
Yes, I showed him the video, and he actually did say, when are we going?
And it's not just, you know, a lot of times bars will do, like, pop-ups, and they have, like, cutouts of Michael Scott and Dwight. They actually brought in, and they did it similar with the Friends experience here in Chicago as well. They brought in NBC, who basically sat down with them and were like, here are the specs for the set.
Here's how far, awesome.
You know, it's like you're walking onto the set. It's incredible. It's incredible. Really if you're cool. If you're around Chicago, it's called The Office Experience. It's on the Mag Mile. It's worth your time.
Is that Marvel thing still in the exhibit?
Yeah. Good luck getting a ticket. It's sold out for. It's been sold out weeks, months in advance. So you'd have to know the local entertainment reporter to get you in.
I was just gonna say, I know you.
Yep.
That can get me in, right?
Oh, it'll get your ass kicked out.
VIP tour.
Last time I was in Chicago, I visited an AT&T store to go to a Game of Thrones chair or the throne. And then ran into Kathleen Kennedy.
See what happens? Great things happen when you come
to
Chicago.
Some of the weirdest things happen in Chicago.
All right. Well, listen, we've killed enough time. Let's get to our interview this week because we have a big one. This happened a while ago. But like everything with Dune, it happened a long time ago and we kind of forgot that it happened. But we had Denis Villeneuve join the show. This is a great conversation. I say that with all humbleness and I think this one turned out really great.
We're kind of the best. I say with
all
humility.
Hopefully you guys agree. Here's Denis talking about Dune on Real Blend.
Obviously, Zimmer's score is amazing, but I want to talk about Greg's cinematography because it is some of the most gorgeous cinematography I've seen on camera in a long, long time. It's incredibly immersive. But I want to talk about the IMAX aspect of it. We have not seen the film in IMAX. We've only seen it in the normal format at the moment. So I wanted to ask you what scenes we can expect from the IMAX format and whether... Yeah, and whether or not the wind and the sand was affecting your cameras at all as you were photographing.
The thing is, that's one of the first decisions that when as a filmmaker, when you prep for a new movie, one of the decisions you will have to make is the format. Will it be scope, 185, 106? Because it has an impact on how you read a movie, how you receive in a movie. And on this one, I kept saying to Greg, I see it as a square format. There's something about the intimacy that it creates, and desert that been embraced so many times on scope. So I was like, it feels like it could be right to go. Quickly we had started to have a conversation about IMAX, to try the immersive feeling of IMAX and how it would be the perfect way to approach the desert in a new way, which would be with the IMAX format. And that's more a squarish format that I deeply love.
Yeah, the 1-4-3-1 that Nolan uses, like in Dunkirk and Tenet.
Yeah, we went for it, and and I would encourage. I would say that's to see it in 1-4-3 is quite an experience. Now, idea was to use IMAX in a way that will when you go from scope to IMAX, it has an impact. And it really creates a punch and a punctuation in the narrative. And of course, the more the movie evolves, the more the movie becomes immersive, the more we are losing frame, and the more the world gets bigger, the more we are in contact with Arrakis. So everything involving the desert, of course, has been shot with the IMAX format, and everything involving dreams as well. That was the way we approached the. So it creates sometime like very experimental punctuation that Greg and I loved, by the way. It's like to play with the punctuations like that will create an impact. It was the first time that I was trying to do this, and it was quite an interesting process, a stimulating process. Now, it meant that we were shooting with two formats. I mean, we didn't shoot everything spherical IMAX. We chose in proper pre-production which scene exactly or which shot would be shot in IMAX and commit to it. We had a saying, Greg Fraser and I, which was, let's burn the boat. There would be no return back. So we all the decisions were made on camera. So it meant that there will be no way to go back to change our mind. Once we were in post-production, we did everything as we were shooting. So it meant that we shot with two formats, which are like spherical IMAX or with anamorphic 2.35. And it's like the way the movie was shot with the Alexa LF, which is a format that I thought brought the something to the image that was very modern, but still had some kind of romantic effect to it. It's like I was thinking that I will shoot the movie in 35. That for me, it was a given. I would shoot Dune in 35. And we were all excited about that. And we made a lot of tests. We tested the 35, 65 millimeter, then the Alexa 65 and LF. And to my, I was like totally destabilized that the look I was dreaming, the thing that was closer to what I had in mind was the Alexa LF. It has a sensuality. And it has a capacity to shoot in the extremes that was perfect for us to shoot the night scene that we were aiming to do in the desert. Because the idea, and it's one of the reasons I work with Greg Fraser on Dune, is that I love how Greg is able to play with natural light, how he is able to embrace nature, and that was at the very heart of the project, you know, to get closer to nature and to try to not create beauty shots, but more to try to catch the power of nature. I thought that from his past work, Greg had amazed me his use of natural light. So it's like We went in the desert and didn't open a spotlight once. Maybe we did one or two shots, but we spent weeks working without just using the power of the sun as a. And the same for night shoots. We were. I said to Greg, I want the nights to feel. Is there a way we could find a way to not having to lit the desert? And anyway, such a thing is impossible, of course. So, but the idea was to try to create a feeling of sensuality and a feeling of proximity, and then something so familiar in the light that you truly believe that you are on a planet for real, and all coming from the natural quality of the light. So we shot in the desert, and just before the night hits us, and it will create that feeling of almost scuba diving feeling that you are on Arrakis, just in a clear night. Yeah, it was kind of very exciting to work this way. But not easy.
Awesome.
Denis, I would like to stay on cinematography, but just jump back one film. I feel like we were all personally invested in Mr. Deakins getting an Oscar, which is ridiculous. It means nothing to us, but it just felt like that was important. What did it mean for you that one of your films was the one that finally got Mr. Deakins his Academy Award?
Listen, for me, I'm still waking up in the morning pinching myself that I had the chance to work with Roger. Seriously, it's like working with Roger has been one, if not the biggest privilege of my life as a filmmaker. And I remember if you had asked me 20 years ago, what would have been my fantasy, what would be a dream of mine to as a filmmaker, I would have said, I would love to work with a master cinematographer, someone that I will learn from, you know, someone that I will, because the cinematographer at the end of the day is your closest partner as you are making a movie. It's become an extension of yourself and an extension of your eye. And there's a proximity and intimacy that you develop with this artist that, and I was saying, I hope one day I will have the chance to work one time with one of these masters, and Roger being the one, I was like, it's a blast for me. And I will say you something, there's in a way, I will dare to say there's the ghost of Deakins is in Dune. Why? Because I spent a year side by side doing VFX with Roger Deakins, and it was like going back to film school, studying light with Roger. And you know, we were each shot in the Blade Runner was supervised by Roger and myself, and I was like Roger was. Adamant or terrible. I wanted to, I don't know if it's the right word, sorry. It was very important for him that the look of the film will look as real and we respected our aestheticism that we had developed. So he supervised with me like no DP had ever done, I think, each shot in Blade Runner. So it's like the cinematography is just not what he captured on set, but as importantly, the nature of the VFX that will be added to his cinematography. So it was a full Deakins experience that they brought up. It allowed me to see the process, to be with him and to listen to him. To on each shot, how can we achieve realism with VFX through lighting? And I learned so much, and as I was doing VFX on Dune, I realized the incredible amount of knowledge I got from Roger, and it really helped me to work on my VFX team and to guide them toward something that feels right. You know?
He's a legend.
Wow.
Amazing.
He is.
Yeah. Way, so guys, are you.
I will recommend strongly if you haven't not seen it, you know that Roger just put in the bookstore a book about his photograph, and it's so beautiful. Black and white a photography from Roger Deakins. It's a stunning book. I will strongly recommend you guys to run to the next bookstore because it's really beautiful. It's like yeah, they're inspiring.
That's amazing. Denis, whenever I heard that you were going to be splitting the story
into...
I'm not
trying to do product placement here.
No, not at all. You're all immediately going to run and go get that book now.
Yeah, no, not at all.
I was just... it's just that he's a tremendous artist. And we are lucky to live. Sometimes you have people like that around and say, wow, I lived through the years of Roger Deakins. So Yeah, and what I didn't answer to your question, but the fact that he won for Blade Runner, I think that frankly, between us, Roger could have won several times before.
Yeah. You know?
So many movies he did were just so beautiful. But of course, like you guys, I was rooting. At one point, I said to Roger, you have nothing to lose. Either your legion increase or either you win. So you're in a win-win.
Right? True. Very true.
Denis, whenever I heard that you were going to be splitting the story into two, I immediately did what most people did, which crack open my book and try to figure out, like, wait, where the hell is he going to split this story? So I have a bit of a two-part question for you. How did you decide where to make the cut between part one and part two? And for the last act of the film, did you shoot anything that you did not use here that might be then saved for part two?
No, the thing is that that was not that was a process that was done in screenwriting. And the truth is that there was a version of the story that was finishing a bit later, meaning that we were going to the siege and then we were having the Water of Life ceremony, all that. And the problem with that version is that after 2 hours and a half to start to, it was like, it really felt like the beginning of something. Mm. It really felt like instead of closing a chapter, it felt like, all right, and now let's start this. And it felt like we were adding another hour to the movie that it felt the movie would have been too long and it didn't felt right. I mean, maybe it feels right in the book, but in the movie, it felt like a second ending and starting more precisely, it felt like we were starting a new story. So a new part of the story, a new chapter. So it felt wrong. And we went back as we were, that of course, all in screenwriting process. And John Spate and I, at the time, we explored this idea. My initial idea was that it should happen, the movie should end when Paul encounter directly a sandworm at the end. There was something, there's a moment there that I was like, was at the apotheosis of the story, that the apex, I think we said in English, of the story. And then finally meeting the Fremen, and we went back to this original idea. The first idea I had, so to make the story a bit more condensed, more tight, with more momentum, and that became the, and we didn't question this after. So once we found the what you saw, this ending, it's exactly how we shot it and how we cut it. There's no other material there. It's like that was the, and it felt right because it felt that Paul's arc in part one, from what he has to go through, was completed, and now at the end he has completed. He has learned things. Yeah, he went through a full transformation, and now he will be ready for part two. In fact, we focused on Paul as it was intended. So it's like, I think that for me it's the perfect ending, which is not exactly the same as in the book.
It's time for Muad'Dib. I'm ready.
Yeah, we're all. Yeah, yes, we're all ready.
It was really funny because on set, sometimes Timothy was in some scene. He said, I was saying to him, Timothy, don't do this like that. He said, yeah, but I'm Muad'Dib. I said, no, you're not Muad'Dib. You're not yet Muad'Dib. You're just Paul Atreides. Go back there. That's later. And he was like, very funny. Am I Muad'Dib? No, you're not.
Yeah, Denis, speaking of product placement, I just spent $600 on that Dune Art and Soul book that you guys made, that Zimmer. I cannot wait to get that. But I'm going back. One of the things that I find interesting is you're talking to a podcast right now that is huge advocates of the theatrical experience. We want to see everything in theaters. That's our goal. It changes everything. And cinematic immersion means so much to us. And Christopher Nolan is the same way. And you both have been very strong advocates about the theatrical experience. And I wanted to know what it means for you to stand alongside someone like Nolan and have that presence of that idea of pushing people to movie theaters in a safe way, but making sure people understand that. But also the idea, I was wondering, did you ever see Tenet? I was wondering if that was a movie you saw. So just kind of, you're standing alongside Nolan, did you see Tenet and what'd you think of it?
The thing is that I will say first that for me, the big screen is not that it's some kind of a nostalgic way of seeing film, or because of box office or whatever. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the immersive quality of a theatrical experience.
Yep.
Which is by the fact that you are in front of a that there's a saying, I think Jean-Luc Godard said, you're looking down at TV and you're looking up at movies, you know? There's something about that, that the screen is bigger than what your field of vision can see. And that immersive quality, the feel that you're being immersed and you're like diving into the image, create something that you cannot experience at home. And also today I will say that sound design, the Atmos sound system, the Dolby Atmos sound system or IMAX system, it's a way of dealing with sound that is becomes almost physical. I mean, when you listen to that, you have a full body reaction toward the impact of the sound on your body and the way the sound moves in the room. You cannot recreate that at home. And it's something that means that the experience become total, immersive. And more importantly, is that in a theater, you're committed. There's an engagement with the object of the film. At home, you can stop the movie. You can have a problem with your dog. You can answer to the phone, but not at a theater. In theater, it's a fully commitment. And that's the way a movie needs. It's an hypnotic experience, like a dream. You cannot control a dream. You're supposed to let go and embrace. And there are so many movies sometimes that when you watch them in the theater, you are forced to abandon yourself in the hands of an artist and to just follow and be guided to the story. And it's not the same when you do this at home. And even more important, I think that as human beings, a communal experience is something that is very important. We are not meant to be isolated. We are meant to be together. And even if your neighbor eats popcorn, or even if your neighbor laughs too loud, it's part of the what it's being human. It's being together and receive the full experience together. And there's nothing more strong than to share emotions together. And at the end, it's at the very core of the human experience. I mean, we are not alone in an asteroid. We are billions of people on the planet. And we, when at the birth of humanity, we were all listening to storytellers on a fire, beside a fire, and we're all together listening to the stories. It's that, that's at the very core of the human experience. I think it's the there's no many other collective experience like that are left in society. And I think that a cinema's role to do more important. I think it's important to say I love streaming. I mean, streaming saved my life in the pandemic. I went through full Criterion channel. I went through back in the cinema history, I saw amazing masterpieces, and it just helped me to go through these terrible months. But, and I love the power of streaming that allows us to go through the memory of cinema, to revisit movie. But I think that it's important that movies are being, have the possibility to be seen by everybody in the same time. Meaning that my problem with streaming is the tribalization of culture. When you have the Apple tribe, the Hulu tribe, the Amazon tribe, the Netflix tribe. If you tell me, I saw this fantastic movie on Hulu, I will say, I have no idea what you're talking about. It's not my choice. And I love the fact that the movies is something can build a bridge among everybody. When Jaws came out, everybody could have access to Jaws in the same time on the planet. There's something beautiful about that.
Interesting.
The idea that cinema is there to build bridge, not to create bubbles. Bon, finish. Okay. Okay. I was blown away by Tenet. I think it's a masterpiece. I think Tenet is like a movie that is an incredible cinematic achievement.
I agree with you 100%. I think
that it's a very complex movie. I had so much fun. I saw it several times, and each time was a blast. And I think the level of mastery of Christopher Nolan is unmatched, and is by far one of the best filmmaker working in the world today, because people don't realize the high level of his cinematic mastery. It's crazy.
Yes.
This guy is crazy good. I mean, me, every time Chris put a movie on screen, and I'm going in a... to see it. Of course, I saw Tenet on theater. I mean, you cannot see a Nolan movie at home. It's that's like, yeah, that makes absolutely no sense. I mean, you have to first receive the full impact of a Nolan movie in a theater. It's like, it's really fascinating to see him evolving from one movie to the other and always pushing the envelope technically, narratively, and always reinventing himself. And for me, it's like it's deeply inspiring to see that master at work. I mean, I deeply love Tenet. That's what I think. Yeah.
Wow, Denis. Yeah. Before we run out of time, and obviously, I wish we had the entire day with you.
So many questions for you. Like, we were up all night writing questions for you. Yeah, I'm being serious.
You guys, yes. Thank you for your enthusiasm. It's super nice.
If you had the ability to show Frank Herbert one sequence from your interpretation of Dune and just get his reaction, I'm curious what you would choose to show him.
Oh, that's a very good question. I think that I would love to show him three scenes. I would love to show him the arrival of the Reverend Mother, followed by the Gum Jabbar. I would love to see how he feel about that. I think that's pretty close to the book. I think I would love to share with him my interpretation of Paul's first journey in the desert with the Duke and Gurney, when they see a harvester for the first time and the first Paul footstep in the desert. I think that it's a slightly different from the book, and I'm pretty proud about how we brought it to the screen, and I would have loved to see what he felt about that approach. And then I think that I would have loved to share with him the final sequence of the movie where Paul finally meets the Fremen, because that very close to what my dream when I was a kid. I remember being in the desert and I was beside Paul Atreides with a camera and listening to Stilgar in the dark, and I had shivers. I was like, oh God, it's so close to what I had in my mind.
Wow.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. I'm going to squeeze in one more before we have to cut you loose. I heard a quote recently, which is the golden age of science fiction is when you're 12 years old. And I know that's an age that many of us were handed this book for the first time. What would 12-year-old Denis think of Dune if he were to sit down and watch it?
But imagine, the truth is that I kept that guy beside me all the way through the shooting process because I was making the movie for him. And he's a tough critic. That's the problem I had to deal with. He's very harsh, very arrogant, very big dreamer. And I didn't want to disappoint him. And it was very difficult for me as a 53 years old filmmaker to try to please that teenager. And sometimes I succeed, sometimes I didn't. And I still have to deal with him. But I will say that that's the way I did this movie, going back to the past and being in a relationship with that part of myself that dreams so big.
Well, Denis, we want to say this is truly an absolute honor to have you on our show. This is a show that we created specifically to have conversations like this. And we've been texting ever since we saw the movie. And this means so much to us. We literally spent our entire Saturday night last night for 3 hours on Zoom going over questions for you today. And this was the list we came up with. And I just want you to know how much this movie means to us, how much your filmmaking has meant to us over the years, from Enemy to Blade Runner 2049, Sicario, everything. You're one of the greatest to ever do it. And it's an honor to have you on our show. Seriously.
It was like all the privilege was mine, and you are very generous with me, and it is very welcome. I thank you very much. I need that energy. So I thank you. I thank you guys. Thank you.
We need to thank WB for giving us time with Denis, who's just a fantastic filmmaker. Obviously, we're going to play him.
From Venice, if I'm wrong.
Well, yeah, that was when the movie was having its big world premiere. Wow. Obviously slammed for time with press and everything going on. So for him to sit down for a long form interview with us is just, we're beyond honored. So
it's unbelievable.
Yeah. And later in the show, we're going to play Denis Villeneuve blend and good luck with that one. So let's get to a few of the bigger topics from the week that has passed. And I mentioned at the beginning of the show that IATSE has agreed to a deal preventing a strike that would, in essence, have shut down the entire film industry. And now crew members can, according to what we're seeing in the terms that are being announced, look forward to more humane working conditions and better pay. I'm a little bit torn on this because from what I've been hearing from a lot of people, at first it was a big splash of this was great, we avoided a strike. But as you're getting into a few more of the details, I've been hearing from people whose lives are directly affected by this, and they're saying maybe we didn't get everything that we were hoping to get. But I think for the time being, the shortage has been the labor shortage, the labor strike and walkout has been prevented. Have you guys heard anything from your side about angles that are happening with it? Or it feels like it's still a work in progress.
Well, there was a Variety article that I was reading earlier that I'm going to literally just quote it. It says, but the drama is not over. The contracts must still be ratified. And many members quickly denounced it on social media. That's a direct quote from Variety. So kind of goes to the point of what you're saying, but I guess it's not official, right? Right. It hasn't been ratified.
Okay, so progress on that end, and we'll continue to track that story because it's a massive story in terms of the number of people that it affects and the industry grinding to a halt if they're not getting the conditions that they need. Disney delayed basically its entire 2022-2023 slate. That affects all the Marvel movies. It affects, not all the Marvel movies, most of them. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 is staying in its May slot. 2023, that's about to start shooting very soon. Doctor Strange gets moved from March to May, I believe, and then everything sort of took a step backwards. The one that really took a hit from that one is Indiana Jones 5, which moves back just shy of an entire year. And so let me talk about the Marvel ones briefly, and then I want to hear from you guys on Indy. Yes, Kev?
I think we'll be a little James Mangolder when that movie finally releases.
Jesus, so will Harrison Ford. He's going to be a lot James Mangolder. Did you guys think that there's any credence to the fact that Marvel moved to get out of the way of the Batman? The Batman opens in March.
I read that online. I mean, first of all, yes, the Batman trailer is absolutely ridiculously amazing. And we're not going to have time to dive into the DC fandom stuff on this show. But that trailer was absolutely phenomenal, right?
It was great.
And I think, and then the news came about Disney delaying, you know, a day or two or whatever it was after that. I saw people online saying that, like, oh, is it because of the Batman? I highly doubt that
If Doctor Strange ends up becoming as big as they think it's going to be, then that's the movie you'd want to put up against.
Yeah.
But I will say, isn't it kind of fun that, I mean, Marvel used to kind of run the gauntlet in terms of, you know, other movies got out of their way.
Right.
And I feel like the Batman is the first movie that, at least whether it's true or not, gives us pause to question, did Marvel get out of the way of the Batman? Like, to me, like, whether or not that's true or not,
sure,
it's exciting that we live in a world where DC is now pumping out films of quality that now make us wonder whether or not Marvel is maybe not shaking in their boots, but going, well, shit, like, we're not the guaranteed winner of that month,
right,
like we normally would be under any other circumstance.
It is pretty interesting. So, of course, Feige walked the red carpet at the Eternals.
What an impossible interview. I don't know how you guys do it. I've never interviewed him before, but anytime I see any of you guys talk to him, it's like trying to do a Rubik's Cube with a gun to your head. I don't know how you do it.
He does sort of dodge the deals. And he said, he claims it was all production. You know, the production schedules meant that they had to push everything back. I was curious, and I fear this. It hasn't happened yet. If it doesn't happen yet, I wonder if it's not going to happen. But once Strange moved out of March, and now there's no Marvel movie in that March slot, that Spider-Man was going to move back.
But Spider-Man could play through the holidays. I mean, Spider-Man opens big in December. It could play all the way into February.
No, I agree. I agree. The only thing would be is if it's not finished. I know John Watts is working very hard at finishing it right now.
Yeah.
But
that's got so much hype, though. That feels too hyped to delay, like to put another bit of like marketing push behind it, like to have to delay it and then restart that is one expensive. Not that they don't have all the money in the world, but they've got such good hype with the whole like Garfield controversy and the trailer was really great. It'd be hard to give up that spot, I think, for them if they ended up doing it.
So what about Indy 5? We are literally going to be waiting a year and a half, if not even a little bit more than that, for that movie to finally open.
Do we know? I saw recently that they're back up. I know Harrison Ford was hurt for a hot second.
Yeah.
And then I saw some new set photos come out. I don't know if that means that he's back and they're good to go and they're filming again, or if those photos came from before the accident, Do we know how far into production they are and how much his injury set them back?
I'm not aware of any sort of status on where they are with it.
But they're filming, and that's well, something.
Yeah, and the release date doesn't affect, like, he can get older off screen now, as long as they capture him now.
Well, dude, this isn't Boyhood, like at a certain point.
Right, exactly. Kevin, are you still going to be interested in that movie well, 2 years from now?
Come on, of course, come on.
Well, of course I'm interested in it, but I mean, I'm still trying to get over the fact that Spielberg's not doing it.
Yeah.
And I'm still trying to get over the idea that 4 was not a good film. I'm still trying to get over the fact that Mangold's a great director, but I just wonder what story felt important enough to make a fifth indie film. I mean, like, you're talking about one, two, and three are classics. And, you know, Temple of Doom, whatever you think about that. I love that movie, but I love all three of them. 4 is just an outlier that I don't even think about in terms of the franchise. But
few do.
Do I, for me, I never thought to myself, I want to see a fifth Indiana Jones. Now, Mangold's one of my favorite filmmakers. Harrison Ford's back. Spielberg is not. I don't know if Lucas is involved in the story credit on this one.
I think that was part of the deal when he sold off Lucasfilm. That also included selling off Indy.
I mean,
oh, that's one of the greatest props I've ever seen in my entire life. When I got a chance to go to Lucasfilm in Northern California, and they have the Grail. The actual Grail. Is
That's
like
awesome.
In a glass case. It's amazing.
Yeah, but I mean, I'll say this. I mean, at the end of the day, am I going to see it? Definitely. I'm just wondering what is driving this film.
Honestly, don't you think that it's Harrison's eagerness to end the series on an upswing?
Sure. Could they be like retroactively fixing the fourth film?
I don't think there's anything you can do to like fix what happened, but I think he would rather leave people. With a good taste in their mouth.
Like Deadpool going back through the timeline and shooting Ryan Reynolds in the head.
Shia LaBeouf is going backward on the vines, like away from the monkeys.
It opens with Harrison with the aliens, and the aliens take him through like a wormhole, and he comes back before that ever happened, and we just get to re-see all of that.
And it's an actual Interstellar sequel.
Yeah, McConaughey is in the whole every scene.
Wait, what was Shia LaBeouf's Mutt?
Mutt.
He could be like, Mutt, instead of Murph. Mutt!
And Ford just watches Indy 4 on the screen that McConaughey does and just starts crying like McConaughey does in Interstellar. He's just like, laughing. Like, he can't. Why?
For some reason, Matt Damon's still there.
Something I do want to see, though, I sent this to you guys. I don't know if we talked about it. It was an older post that, like, resurfaced. From this concept artist who talked about working on this concept for I think it was a show, maybe. I don't know if it was a movie or a movie series. But I love the idea. You guys know I love Short Round. And it was the idea that the concept was that Short Round grows up and becomes like an indie. Like instead of Mutt or whatever that was, it kind of felt more natural of him like coming up and kind of filling in indie shoes. And the concept art had all these very like indie inspired. I was like, dude, that's badass. I would love to see a Short Round like series or something. Based around like, him kind of following in his footsteps.
That would be cool.
Like I said, what Gabe has just said is exactly what my point is about Indy. If there's a good story, and a good enough story to propel forward, like what he's talking about, like that sounds interesting to me.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
You want to hear this pitch? Kev, I think you're going to want to hear this pitch.
Please.
Drew McWeeny has been writing about film forever. I love Drew,
by the way. Shout out to Drew.
Drew's awesome.
Great writer.
Terrific guy.
Yeah.
Great writer.
Yeah. He was on a podcast and I heard him say this. And the minute I heard it, I was like, how on earth did they not green like that?
Oh.
He thinks they should have done a True Lies movie where Eliza Dushku, their daughter, is a spy later, like as an older person.
Yeah.
And she gets in a mess and her parents have to come help her. And
So Arnold
and Jamie.
Were they going to call it Fake Truths?
Fake truths.
The
thing is, I feel like your joke, but like I feel like that would be a great name for it. Like that would be like kind of like a wink and a nudge to like that's fantastic.
Isn't that a
great
pitch?
That's a
great
idea too.
That's a
because
great pitch.
Terrific.
The cool
pitch.
Thing about that would be, first of all, the characters can age naturally.
Sure.
So Eliza aged to where she is. Jamie Lee Curtis ages to where she is, and Arnold. Yeah, right. And so like. And they could even play around with the idea that maybe Arnold can't do the same things he used to do in terms of
Absolutely.
Action. But like Oh my god, what a great idea.
It's so easy.
I love that story. That's a good concept.
I mean, that could also be like sort of the whole thing with like Indy 4, not to make that comparison, but like he's getting older. So write that in this, write the fact that he can't. Don't try to convince us that he can. Address the fact that he can't.
Yep.
I will never get over De Niro's older body with the younger face kicking that guy on the ground in Irishman, and it just looked
I'm an apologist for that movie a lot. I love that movie, but that's one scene that's one scene where I went like, just get a body double.
Yeah.
Let's jump through what the things that are going to be opening up soon in movies, because we want to leave time for us to be able to talk about Dune. So there's a film coming to Netflix. This is where we run through who's seen what. It's a film coming to Netflix called Night Teeth. Anyone seen Night Teeth?
Nope.
There's a film going to limited release called Warning. Anyone see Warning?
I do like that.
Green Day's podcast, album, Warning.
Yeah.
That is a great, that's great.
Great album.
Green Day album. Yeah. There's an animated film called Ron's Gone Wrong. Anyone seen Ron's Gone Wrong?
Nope.
All right, excellent. Wes Anderson has a film coming out called The French Dispatch. Has any of us seen The French Dispatch
yet? I see it tomorrow.
In my area, it comes out the 29th, so I don't know.
It's limited.
It's limited tomorrow.
Yes. Yeah, so I haven't seen it. I can't wait to see it.
All right, I see it in Savannah soon, so I'm looking forward to that. All right, well, that brings us to Dune. Coming to HBO Max on Thursday.
No. Why did you even mention that,
Sean?
I will mention real quick, though. So the way we're going to do this week, and give us some feedback if you like this. This is one of these new Friday things we can start doing. We are going to do our usual spoiler-free review of Dune. Everyone can kind of talk about what they love, and star ratings if they have them and they want to give them. And I think it's safe to say we all recommend this. But then we will move into spoilers where we can get into details. Check the show notes for timestamps. I will give you plenty. We will give you plenty of warning before we start on spoilers, and I will have it timestamped out so you know where they begin and end. And if you're on YouTube, there's little chapters that you can jump to for the spoiler section. And join us on the Blend Game, which was coming next. Anyway, go ahead. Spoiler-free review of Dune.
I want to go first, and I just want to say that.
That's funny though.
My expectations for this were fairly high, but the main reason why they were high were for Denis. Mm-hmm. Just because I knew I would appreciate the filmmaking and the craft, with him being, you know, just as talented as he is. But I didn't nearly expect to get as caught up in the story as I did. Obviously, I know the Frank Herbert's novel is classic, and, you know, it's been dubbed unadaptable. But what made this work so well for me, without getting into any spoilers, is just how great the cast is. Like, everyone who he brings to the ensemble is so perfect in their part that it made me know the world and feel immediately comfortable in the world, whether it was Brolin or Oscar Isaac and Rebecca Ferguson. Playing Paul's parents. I thought Timothy was great as Paul because of the attitude that Paul is almost supposed to have, you know, that he, thinks it's his time to lead, but he also kind of questions whether it's his time to lead. I thought across the board, he got everybody down pat perfectly, including when you cut over to the quote unquote antagonists side of the story. Batista and Stellan Skarsgård and these other actors who are supposed to be playing these parts, who again will become more significant when we get into part two. I thought Javier Bardem stepped into the movie and stole his first scene. And again, somebody said this. They said, you know, I forget who said this on Twitter, but like part of the reason why I love Javier Bardem as much as I do is his ability to step into an ensemble that's loaded with Academy Award winners and just remind you that, like, oh, I'm one of the best working now.
My Oscar wasn't a fluke.
So this really did feel like a lengthy movie that flew by. I'll save this part for the spoilers. I'll save this section for the spoilers because Kevin and I had a conversation right after we got out of it. And there's something significant about it that I want to discuss, but I'll leave it at spoilers. Highly recommend it. 4.5 stars out of 5. It's not a perfect movie to me, but it's one of the best things I've seen this year, and it needs the big screen. Kev, I think you're kind of on the same wavelength.
Oh yeah, I mean the movie, it's so funny because when I saw it, I loved it, but as time has passed and I've thought about it more and more, I've loved it even more. I've only seen it once, so it's been about 4 weeks now, 5 weeks now since we've seen the film. Lots of things I want to mention in terms of why it's incredible. Well, first of all, Denis is one of the greatest directors working today. Okay, the guy is operating on Nolan's level, I would argue, because he hasn't really made a bad film. He makes films that audiences deserve. We deserve these types of movies. Audiences do. Because there is a way to tell great stories in an immersive environment with great storytelling and do it well and practically as much as possible. They shot so much of this stuff on location. I think Chalamet said they did like 2 green screen scenes. Mm. You are transported into this world from the moment the film starts. A lot of that has to do with Zimmer too. I think it's probably one of Zimmer's top scores of his career. It's so different than anything he's ever done. The sound design, the sound mixing, everything that's involved in the filmmaking comes together in this beautiful cinematic experience where you are transported to this world and you are living with these characters. You do not realize you're in a movie theater. You do not realize you're watching a movie. It's pure cinematic immersion. And like I've said this in my interviews, there's only a few moments in my life where I remember like that type of immersion changing for me, like seeing a filmmaker take me to another level of immersion. Dark Knight, 70mm IMAX, truck flip, that changed everything for me. This is right there in terms of what it did to transport me to the world and what Denis does with the storytelling. Another thing I want to say about this, I did not read the book. Going into the film, I knew nothing really about the story. I watched the trailers, I knew basic premise, I knew there was a Matrix vibe to the idea of the story, obviously written well before the Matrix, but that concept of the One. I found this movie so beautifully pleasing to follow. And I say that in a way where I think exposition is such a key thing that directors have either a hard time with or they're really good at. Denis is brilliant with exposition. So what this film does really well in terms of exposition is he explains the story and every aspect of it through natural moments of dialogue and through natural moments. Like there's scenes where like Chalamet is like learning about things, right? We are learning about it with him. So sure. We're learning the information with him. Like when you do exposition well, you're treating the audience like they're smart. And this is a film that is like that could have been really hard to follow if you did not read the book. But for me, I was fully engaged. I knew all the characters, all the houses, everything. It all made perfect sense. From a performance standpoint, Momoa, it's the best thing he's ever done.
Oh, yeah.
What a performance from Jason Momoa. Just absolutely crushed it. Has some of the best scenes in the whole film. Skarsgård is one of the most terrifying and disturbingly disgusting villains I've ever seen. Just the way he eats freaked me out. This was like Brando style Apocalypse Now, like disturbing. It was wild. And that's pretty much what I want to say. I feel genuinely lucky that we live in a world that I get to be alive watching this filmmaker exist. As I said that, my eyes looked over at a Hitchcock poster I have on my wall. And that's the one filmmaker I always said to myself, I wish I was alive during his filmmaking period so I could have experienced it like everybody else did. Now I'm experiencing it in the future.
It was pretty special.
Right. You know what I mean? And so, but, yeah, Sean's 80 years old. No, but in all honesty, like, we are blessed with some incredible filmmakers in our time, in our lifetime. Tarantino and obviously Nolan and Denis are at a level for me where I know that they give a shit about my experience watching their film. Mm-hmm. They care so much about it that they, and that's the problem with the HBO Max thing, and we can get into this later. They're releasing a day early on HBO Max. I mean, I know that movies eventually leave theaters and they come to DVD shelves and they come into your home, and most of the movie's life is lived out of a theater. But this movie is designed for a movie theater. And as Denis said in our interview, this blows up to the 1.43 IMAX like Nolan. It's going to be insane. I haven't even seen it in IMAX yet, and it still blew my mind. I've only seen it in the 2.39 or 2.35, the widescreen format.
Well, and not everybody's going to be able to see the full.
Yeah.
Even so, the full.
I'll tell people how. So this is interesting. I'll keep this quick, though. if you're trying to see the film in IMAX, there's only maybe less than 30 theaters in the entire country, our United States, that can play the film in the full true IMAX that he shot it in.
Sure.
But
which makes me wonder why filmmakers do it. And I know it's special, but it really, if no one can see it that way, why?
I could be wrong, because but I do think that IMAX helps pay for production and stuff whenever they're involved.
Also,
or at least marketing.
Also, to Sean's point, though, the majority of people who see Dune in IMAX are going to see a 190, which is still a gigantic, gigantic screen. It's still going to bump up to the 190. So the majority of people will still get that IMAX quality. It's the cameras, really. When you watch like a Chris Nolan film at home or in an IMAX theater and they jump to those IMAX scenes, it looks better than any HD 4K I've ever seen. Like, it's film and it looks better than HD. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, all right. So I'll wrap it up because we'll get to Jake. But I believe this is a movie we deserve. I'm at a 5 out of 5. And we'll get into Sean's point in a second, because I do want to talk about that. But I'm just thankful that we are living in a time where we get to watch this filmmaker flourish. Like, he is an absolute master, and it's a cinematic experience unlike anything I've ever seen before. Go see it in theaters, please, if you can. And if you live in the DC area and you want to see it in the 143, the full IMAX, go over to Udvar-Hazy in Chantilly. They have it. Or if you're in LA, they have it at City Walk. If you're in New York, they have it at Lincoln Square. If you're in Canada, they have it at Cinesphere. And I know all these theaters because I saw Dunkirk at all of them in 70mm IMAX. So I went on a tour for that movie. So I would love to go on a tour for this one.
Jake, you hated it. Why? What went on?
It was horrible. No, you know, what's funny is that, just to correct, I mean, just in case you don't follow the show, no, I did not hate it. I love the film. You know, what I think is maybe most impressive about this, and everything you guys said is absolutely right. But one thing I do want to point out as well is that Denis, in a lot of ways, in terms of storytelling, is behind the eight ball a little bit, because since that Frank Herbert novel was so seminal in influencing some of the great sci-fi storytellers of our time, you know, everything from Star Wars to The Matrix, the whole idea of the One and the Force and, you know, everything. There are a lot of aspects about Dune that might seem familiar to people who are unfamiliar with the influence that novel had. And it's easy to look at certain scenes, you know, when Paul Atreides has to use, you know, the voice and say, well, that's just Luke Skywalker doing the voice. Or I'm sorry, doing the Force. Or, you know, there are aspects of Paul Atreides where, you know, he's going to, you know, become Muad'Dib and be like, well, that's just Neo becoming the One. You know, it's... But Denis films it in such a way and presents it in such a way that even though we've seen other storytellers and filmmakers give us different variations of that source material, of that Frank Herbert source material over the last 50 or 60 years, it still feels new, and it still feels fresh, and it still feels like something that I've never seen before. And that's one of the things I was worried about going in, is if we've seen the influences, what is the source material going to matter? And I still feel like it absolutely does. It still feels like a completely different entity. The scope in which he, you know, the whole thing with film is that, you know, it really is like a time machine. You know, it transports you across space and time. You know, if a film is done right, if it hits you right, if it lands right, if the theater's right, if all these different elements align, like the planets, just kind of the right way, for 2.5, sometimes 3 hours, you can forget that you're in a movie theater. You can forget that you've got a place to be after. You can forget that you had a fight with someone before you walked in the theater. And that's kind of how I felt. And I haven't felt that way in a while walking into a movie theater, where it's just like, it wasn't even like the four walls were there. It wasn't like the screen was there. It wasn't like the speakers were there. It was kind of like I was just sitting on Arrakis watching what was going on.
Yep.
And it was such, you know, and Kevin, you used the word like immersive. Like that is what it is. I mean, and he nails it in such a way that they're not playing catch up. They're not speaking down to you. It's just sort of like, here's what's going on. And you follow along. You got it. We believe in you. You can do this. You can go with it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, because I walked out feeling both grateful for the filmmakers who were able to tell amazing stories over the last 60 years because of that source material, but then also I was very happy that maybe we finally got that source material at the day and age that we did, because obviously we saw this try to be made in the early 80s. For so many reasons, it wasn't able to work out. So I think maybe now is just the right time to get this story. So for a lot of reasons, I am deeply, deeply, deeply in love with Dune Part 1.
5 out of 5? 5 out of 5.
Easy.
Okay, let's shift us into the spoiler talk for Dune, because there's a couple of things that we need to discuss in terms of judging this movie specifically. And I don't want them to sound like a knock on the film, but there are things that I can't overlook when judging this movie in particular, starting with the fact that it's half the story.
Sure.
And I understand that...
But you love Lord of the Rings, and that's...
That's not true. For casual audiences who are encouraged to go check this out, who might listen to all of us who say, like, hey, if you haven't seen a movie in 10 years, this is the one to go back to. And they sit through 2.5 hours of this movie and they get to the end and it isn't resolved. That's going to annoy a lot of people.
Go ahead.
Maybe they'll enjoy the ride. Maybe they'll enjoy what they went on up to this point. But there's a spot when this movie ends that is very much a continuation and, you know, a tease of where it's supposed to go from this point. So I don't think that the film, as well as it could, operates as a capped off, you know, if Dune 2 doesn't happen, this is still productive, you know, still was his own thing. It so heavily wants you to see what comes next that until we're out of this limbo, it's hard for me to judge the entire story.
I think it's fair to say it's hard to judge the entire... I get what you're saying. It's not a... I wouldn't say it's an invalid point, but I disagree, I think. Because it does, but a lot of things do that. A lot of things leave you with a tease. A lot of things leave you with, you know, this doesn't have an end-credit scene, but an end-credit scene that says, like, more is coming. You know, the Avengers will return. I think maybe maybe the issue is we know there's more. We know that this is a giant, big story, because I think if you go in completely cold, well, this is a story about... this family getting relocated and then being betrayed. It's kind of a political story. And I think it does have that well capped off the way that he sectioned it. It's its own story. If you look at it as Duke Leto and his family sort of being betrayed in this sort of political opera of sorts, galactic political opera. And I think it does a really great job of piecing that together from Kaladin to Dune and then to sort of him meeting up with the Fremen. So I disagree in the sense that I think a normal audience, a casual audience and a someone going in cold that maybe doesn't even know that it's supposed to have all these different aspects to it and supposed to be this, you know, grand story on the level of Lord of the Rings, as some might describe it. I think it does manage to keep a contained story in one film. But I agree that it's certainly open-ended. It's certainly saying, like, which I wonder, I'd be curious... if we ever got to talk to Denis again, of like, was that strategic when you knew that you only had one left? Did you put an emphasis on, I need this to end with a what the hell happens next, or people are going to be pissed? You know, like, he's trying to get the audience on his side to greenlight another one.
I mean, the last line of the film is literally, "This is only the beginning."
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting because Sean and I had a discussion about this too, because that was a weird thing. Where to me, where the movie ends, it is half the story, and I do find that if you tell people that before going to see it, it changes that how hard that hits at the end. So, for example, Lauren went and saw it last week. I saw it 3 or 4 weeks prior. And I was like, listen, just so you know, this is Dune Part One. Like, the title card says Dune Part One. He kind of gives himself an out there with that Dune Part One title card. Well, it's basically saying, like, this is just part one of the story.
He structured it as a trilogy with Dune and then the Dune Messiah book as like the third. Right.
Because Dune Messiah, I'm sorry, I have not read it, Gabe, but like, I have been told by friends who have that, like, Dune Messiah almost that even the, like, because Dune itself doesn't necessarily tie up, like, it's not like everything's tied up by that, like, Dune Messiah kind of wraps everything up. So would he make Dune Messiah the third movie?
I think that makes sense, because like, I've never read all of Dune Messiah, but the way that Dune kind of works the book, you get sort of like snippets of what comes after the events of Dune. Like you get a lot of there's a character that you're sort of getting these excerpts that like tell the grander story of Paul Atreides that even happens after the events of Dune. And so I think the novel itself kind of is trying to make it feel a little bit like there's a little bit more closure of like what comes next. But yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Well, the other thing I want to throw in there too, that's sort of tied to this, is that now that we're in the spoiler talk, I can mention that, and this is only having seen it the one time through, and maybe it'll play differently when I know where it's going, but all of the events that happen after the attack, after the big battle, the film, to me, can't sustain the momentum of everything that led up to that. So I think we probably have another half hour of footage that happens afterwards with Rebecca Ferguson and Timothée Chalamet running away, and then getting tracked and then picked up by Bardem and Zendaya's tribe. I'm not familiar enough with the terms. That bit, while it was fine, you know, it didn't nearly captivate me as much as everything that led up to the move to Arrakis and then the battle.
Well, the movie basically like essentially climaxes in that battle sequence, in my opinion. But
yeah,
what's fascinating, it's so interesting because when I got out of the film, that was like, you know, I knew that I was blown away by what I experienced. I knew that I loved what I watched, but as I texted you, you guys, I was like, this feels like it's just half a movie. But when you really think about like the idea of this is the beginning of Paul's journey, he doesn't even become that character in this particular movie. He doesn't ever become, or Chalamet believes he doesn't become that character in this particular story, in part one. I mean, the Dune part one title card to me is all the audience needs to know when they sit down. As long as they see that, and the movie ends where it ends. But I think, Sean, the discussion you and I were having was how will a general audience get this? Like if they're not in the know in terms of like the world, like Gabe was saying, like we know there's a sequel, we want it greenlit, etc. You know, does the average audience member walk out disappointed? Does it get a bad cinema score because it ends in the middle of the story? It's one of those things where like I'm almost like worried how people are going to handle it. Like, because I loved it so much, but I also understand and agree with you on the half a movie aspect.
Sure,
yeah. Where it is half the story.
Or if you're a Zendaya fan and you think she's going to be in it a lot.
right. And they're promoting the movie as if she's the star.
It's one of the things that are going against the marketing.
She
Jake,
is.
You had something
really interesting.
Yeah, well, I'm curious as to how you guys feel about this. Whenever I talk to people about the whole part one, part two thing, it's not so much that it's split into part one, part two that bothers people. A lot of times I tell people, that's it. A lot of times I tell people, hey guys, heads up, like this is just half the book. It ends on a cliffhanger. The title card says part one. And I can't tell you how many times people follow up with, okay, cool, cool, cool. So like, when does part two come out?
Yeah.
And I go, well,
yeah,
not only have they not shot it, they haven't even officially said it's going to happen,
which is
yet.
Such,
and that's what throws people
off. That's a problem.
Yeah, and Sean, that was the whole thing, was like when that ended, I wasn't really worried or concerned about where it ended. It was, oh my god, it ended there. But we don't have the second part of the film shot.
Sure. Yep, exactly.
Or greenlit.
And I think that dictates
me out.
His lack of, as a filmmaker, his lack of knowledge of whether he can even continue this story dictates how he treats the end of his movie. No director wants to go into a project not knowing what their ending is, and he can't know. He can't know, and that's very frustrating from a director's standpoint, from the film standpoint.
Do they announce it this week? Like, it's Wednesday. It's Wednesday, the week of release. I'm timestamping this so people know when we're recording this in case anything happens. Do they, in theory, they would have to do it. We talked about whether or not they were going to announce it before the film comes out. In theory, they would have to do it either later today or tomorrow. Do they greenlight it tomorrow?
I don't think so.
Well, that was what we were texting, but here's the scary thing, and I know we've said this before, but we need to say this again. The movie is on HBO Max a day early, which is a slap in the face to the film, in my personal opinion. Second of all, it has to have a theatrical run that you hope does well, where it's profitable enough that they'll want to greenlight it.
That's off the table, I think. They cannot hold this to some sort of theatrical accountability if they're going to release it a day early and on streaming at the same time.
Like, aren't you worried about that? Or isn't that worry you?
Well, no, I mean, like, who's to say? Like, those rules don't apply. Like, if they come out and say it didn't do enough in theaters, we're not going to do it, like, then we can just talk... We can call bullshit on that. They can't allow that. That doesn't make any sense.
You can't cut off someone off at their knees and then complain that they didn't run the marathon fast.
Exactly. Now, if they say across all platforms, whatever, it didn't do enough for us,
no one watched it on HBO Max. And no
then
one
that's, in a, you know, that's unfortunately the business that we're all in of hundreds of millions of dollars to make these things and those people make
those
decisions.
Has this ever happened before in the history of cinema where... half a story was made, and then the other half didn't was it Divergent? They didn't finish
they
that
didn't
series.
Finish that.
Well, yeah. Golden Compass was supposed to be a franchise. It has happened before, sure.
To this extent, though, it is pretty. Too. It's different to this extent, other than maybe the Divergent series, where they even allowed him to put part one in the title, and they allowed him to end on "This is just the beginning," which I think was the right way to do. For us, the audience, but for them, that sets them up.
Because you know, like what it did, like it kind of hit it in the back.
Yeah,
it was the very last thing that came up as a title card. And they called it "It Chapter One,"
which they probably added way late. Yeah. You know, yeah, like right before it came out.
Because that story wraps itself up, and even like on the way out,
it works.
Because I was only person in our. I went and saw it with a big group, and I was the only person in that group that had read the book. I kind of was like, "Hey, do you get what they said? They said like, if they're adults, that they're going to come back. Like that's why it says part one." And they're like, everyone's "Oh, okay."
Okay. One thing that's really important to note, though, is that when you review this film, you're reviewing it as the film you saw, right?
Yeah,
I mean, like
you have
the industry inside knowledge that we have about them not shooting or green lighting part two, or that there's another part coming, and all those things. Like that's why, like after I got out of the film, my anxiety was about the fact that they haven't shot part two, so I'm like, because I wanted it so badly after seeing part one. But if you take a step back, which I have in these past few weeks, and just look at the movie as a whole, and yes, it does end halfway through the story, it's still I think a perfect film in terms of from a filmmaking perspective, from an acting perspective, from a score perspective, you know, from sound mixing, everything. It is a phenomenal movie.
Yeah, but
it's it's hard. I know what Sean's saying. It's hard. It is hard to say it's a whole movie because it is half the story.
But even if the ending of the movie was the end of the story, I still think it has a momentum problem in that it goes too far after the battle. It goes too far after that battle. That battle is such the pinnacle of the movie.
You didn't like the battle. Not that you didn't like, but the build up with the Fremen. When they are running from the sandworm, and then he has the whole battle where he kind of becomes a Fremen. That for me, that was exciting and intense. Like
I feel yes,
it
it's was,
not
a,
it,
yes,
it
it's not like a bunch
it
of
wasn't the battle. Yeah.
Okay,
and I feel like the sandworms got a moment in that other spectacular sequence when they're hovering over them and the sandworm swallows that craft.
That's a great moment.
That's a tremendous sandworm moment.
You go see
Sandworm
Robert Ryan, and after like the first 30 minutes, you're like, this movie has a momentum problem.
No, that's not the movie. Dune is pretending to be
But if it ended on the battle in the city, isn't it just another movie that ramps up to a big space battle with explosions?
Yes. Well, but okay, so I would have been fine. And again, this is nitpicking.
I know, we're nitpicking. We all love 4.5 out of 5 for you.
I would have been fine with a couple of scenes of exposition, you know, following the battle of like, here's where everybody is kind of, and here's where they could potentially go. I thought it kept going. So then as it kept going, I was like, okay, well now we need to get to a thing. Mm-hmm. And then when it got to the thing, it was a little bit just like, well, now it's over. And I was like, okay.
Interesting about the ending, though, is that it's the ultimate I need more right now.
Yeah.
The last 60 seconds are a teaser. Like, you see a person riding the sandworm. You like, get the hint that he's going to be someone. It's a trailer for the next film.
For you guys who haven't read, I wanted to ask you, I was curious, with that ending, how much more do you feel like you have to discover? Not just the story of, like, how is it going to end, quote-unquote, but... And I think it was intending to do this with what I know comes next. did that ending leave you with a, oh, we barely know these people and we're going to learn a lot more? Or do you just feel like, oh, he's going to be with these people and I'll see how the story ends?
That one.
Interesting.
That one. Yeah.
Because I think what they were going for and what it's saying is when you see someone writing the sandworm, that is supposed to be a reveal of like, that's why she had the hooks, and go, they ride sandworms and you're about to find out that the Harkonnen's understanding of the Fremen is a, again, another brilliant thing that he's including in this novel, is a very sort of compartmentalized. And
they ride sandworms?
They ride sandworms now.
That's pretty dope. They ride now?
I mean,
so sorry, Sean, that's interesting.
No. But Sean's point is valid, and I had the same, a similar reaction, but when you step back and look at it as a film, it's brilliant.
I mean, I do want to see it again.
Insane.
I'm looking forward to seeing it again.
It's an incredible, incredible film. It really is.
I do want to add before we move on that I think it's a perfect adaptation of the book. I'm curious. I haven't read too many people who are like fans of the book and what they think of this. I think it's a perfect adaptation, not in that it's a page for page sort of, you know, Watchmenification of it, which I think Watchmen's a perfect adaptation. That's a different story. But because he clearly has a complete handle on the characters and their role in the story and their traits and sort of the way they should be personified on screen and the way they're personified in your head when you read the book. And also a sense of what the larger elements that happen in the book, in the plot itself, and kind of why they exist. And he truly adapts them into a film that captures that. And not only captures those specifics, but captures the tone of the book. The book itself is much worse at exposition than this movie is. The book itself has full, like, you're like, I'm reading this chapter just so they can tell me that this is how the Galactic Empire is structured. And it works for the book. It's
like, you fool, you know that this does this, does this, right. does this.
On a movie, you guys, eyes rolled, you'd be looking at the side of the screen, it would be the end of the world. Mm-hmm. But he still, he knows, like, yes, but you needed to know that there's an emperor in this structure without us doing, you know, an hour and a half on scenes that don't need to be there. So I think it's a perfect adaptation in that he truly understands the material and is also happens to be one of the best filmmakers working today and made the best version of it that he could in the medium, which is hard to find.
No one else, before we move on, no one else answered, do you think it gets greenlit before the movie opens? Sequel gets greenlit.
I mean, when we were on the text thread the other day, I was like, they're going to greenlight the sequel Thursday or Friday to make a story to push people to the theater.
And they could.
But that was, I mean, that's what I thought they would do, and that's what I hope they would do. But here's the thing, at the end of the day, Gabe said this, that WB allowed him to put part one on screen.
Sure.
And it ends with a line that literally tells you there's more.
Yeah.
So then there's no reason that they haven't done it yet.
It's the weirdest thing. I think if they end up not, if this is the last we get of it, although I believe they're also developing a Dune series, like based on the Bene Gesserit. So it's like they seem very invested in the IP. Like, I think they want to build it out as, like, you know, for corporate speak sake, an IP and a brand that they can sort of have, not just movies, but TV shows, potentially video games or something like that. Like, I think they want to do more with it. If they don't greenlight the rest of this, I think it is it'll be like a historical thing in sort of film history of a weird decision, like a weird thing that shouldn't have happened that happened, where we have this another thing on Dune itself, sort of like a scorecard of weird things of being, you know, whether it's Jodorowsky's Dune, which got canned, but inspired, you know, Star Wars and all these other things, or it's the 80s Dune that is just sort of a universal flop. This will be yet another thing of, like, remember when they made half of it perfectly and then they said, nah, no thanks, we don't want to
remarkably on brand, but they gave Zack Snyder 4 hours to make a movie that teases
two
other films that we'll never get to
hopefully
see.
They learned that lesson. Like, I hope, I've said along the way, like, I feel
same studio too,
hopefully, I've wishfully thought that it's been greenlit in the background, and for some reason they're holding out on that. Mm. Maybe they're trying to hedge their bet, but it very much putting part one in the title.
Oh, can we do another guess where we guess the opening?
Oh, the numbers?
The numbers.
Go ahead, I'll write them down.
All right, let's really quick guess the box office for Dune this opening weekend. Jake, where are you?
I'm going to say 35.
Kev, where are you?
Well, Blade Runner 2049 did 32 million without an HBO Max. I mean, I wanted to do 45, 50, 60, 70, 80. Realistically, 27.
Oh, wow. All right. I think it does long. I think it does 40.
Ooh.
I'm saying 40.
I'd be happy with 40.
I hope what happens is the opposite. I hope it's the opposite of Bond, and it's like
it opens at 125.
125.
Kevin's original Bond number.
We're getting every right. Dune thing adapted for till the end of time.
My prediction is all based on the fact that it's on HBO Max.
Yeah.
A day early.
But the HBO Max audience isn't going to see it there. I don't think they're going to see it there, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So let's get to the blend game. Piracy is a bigger problem than HBO Max. I think piracy is a bigger problem because it's open internationally, but that's neither here nor there.
Wait, can I just give some good? I was gonna say I'm gonna go to 30 for me, just because I just don't want to say the 20s. 30? I feel bad about saying 27. Okay, right. I'm gonna go 30.
Corrected to the 30s. Right.
The blend game, Denis Villeneuve blend. We've been talking about Denis the whole show. I'm gonna go with a film that I've talked about several times on the show. It's Arrival. Arrival is his perfect film. I think it's more perfect than Blade Runner. I think it's more perfect than Dune. Why? Because it has an ending. It has a perfect ending that ties everything up in a delicious bow that still has a very complicated choice for our main character to make. I love, 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 love Amy Adams, and I think she's outstanding in this movie. The tech to portray the ships and the alien and the use of language is also incredibly brilliant. Script is amazing. It's a perfect fit of material and filmmaker. And I'm not quite sure if he keeps working for the next 20 to 30 years that he will top Arrival, honestly, because I just think it's that perfect. So I have to pick it as my favorite film of his. A lot of times he does come across as a filmmaker that I appreciate. And having gone back, I rewatched Blade Runner 2049 in preparation for Dune. And I was like, oh, damn, even though I loved that movie when it came out, I was like, this is so much more. Like, he's working on another level, obviously.
Yeah.
But Arrival is going to be my favorite when I have to pick it. So, Kev, where are you? You're there, too?
Yeah, Arrival is definitely his masterpiece. But I will say this, you know, I'm just going to put it out into the world positively. Once we get Dune Part 2, if it happens, I will be interested to see that full picture. Because, you know, again, Dune part one, the part that's coming out this weekend, even though they're calling it Dune in the marketing, I think fans are going to be like, oh, there's a Dune part one. But I do believe that movie itself is a great film, but I want to see his complete Dune film.
Sure.
Like literally part one, part two, back to back. And then I would be able to say if that's better than Arrival or not.
Okay.
At the moment, in terms of a full structured story, Arrival, no question. Johan Johansson's score, perfect. Every single beat of that film, the twist, blew my freaking mind. When those flash, when they were presented as flashbacks, but yes, they were actually flash forwards.
Yes.
Like I can't remember. All I remember is just like my jaw hitting the floor, and not since Gone Baby Gone had I walked out of a film questioning something so moral,
yeah,
and interesting. Because, you know, for people who have seen Arrival or you know, who haven't, there's a decision that Amy Adams' character has to make at the end of that film that is so incredibly heartbreaking. But you see both sides and you're like, I mean, but, you know, there's a whole argument for why she does it, a whole argument for why she shouldn't have done it. But it is, it is just a brilliant film, every aspect of it. And when she gets up into the ship and has that conversation and like learns everything and like, you know, the idea of the character saving, you know, it was just unreal.
I think Arrival is the movie that Chris Nolan thinks he's making every time.
No.
We don't have enough time for that.
It's no Interstellar.
Oh,
but
listen. Arrival is so much better than Interstellar.
What? No, it's not. Oh, my God. Listen, yes. Arrival's a 5 out of 5, but Interstellar is a 6 out of 5. Interstellar is a masterpiece, but so is Arrival. Okay. But we're talking
you're,
about... Like,
you're touching on why I hate number starring and numbers, right? Yeah, there. You're touching on my...
But basically, like, you know, Villeneuve and Nolan are, in my opinion, on even playing fields at this point. Like, they're just knocking out.
Why do you hate
out.
Tarantino? I don't understand.
I love Tarantino. Well, Tarantino, he's been around for how many years now?
Tarantino's a 9 out of 5.
Jakey, where are you? What's your choice?
I'm going Blade Runner 2049.
Ooh.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, it's funny how we... You know, we say Dune Part 1, and inevitably, I believe, we're going to say Dune Part 2. To me, I've gotten to the point where I feel like Blade Runner 2049 is so necessary to that story that, to me, in my heart, it's almost like it's Blade Runner Part 1 and Blade Runner Part 2.
Interesting.
In the same way that Dr. Sleep is such a necessary completion to The Shining that I never knew needed completion,
right.
I feel like Blade Runner 2049 makes me, in a weird way... feel like Blade Runner is incomplete and not the full story, and Blade Runner 2049 is so good and so substantial and so connected and so just viscerally intertwined with its source material that it feels like it was always meant to be told that way. It feels like we just got it many decades later from a different filmmaker.
Did Ridley ever review Blade Runner 2049? Did he ever comment on it?
I think he did comment on it. I have to look it up.
Did he give his James Cameron thumbs up that James Cameron gives on all his things?
Yeah.
Let me find this while you guys are talking,
whatever Terminator it is, James Cameron's like, best one. Best one.
Ridley's pretty salty.
Yeah, Ridley does believe. I think someone asked him about the Alien series the other day, and he's like, it won't be better than the first one, which he's probably right.
That's the thing. Like, we always talk about this with Ridley Scott, where we go, like, is he arrogant or whatever? And I go, yeah, but he's never wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's the Lebowski quote. Like, you're not wrong. You're just an asshole.
Yeah, exactly.
That's sort of how I feel.
No.
I'm going to be quick because I got to jump off pretty soon. But, like, basically that's it, is that, like, between Deakin cinematography, Denis's direction, Harrison Ford gives a performance that proves that he still has the capacity to give a damn when he gives a damn.
Yeah.
You know, Gosling is so subdued, but still, like, does so much with that role. It's a great film noir that feels like a 1940s film that's set in 2040.
Anna de Armas, who's now just powerhouse?
Yeah, performer? which you know. It's you know, Blade Runner is one of my all time favorite films. It's one of the greatest sci fi films ever made, and 2049 is a sequel that somehow made that film better. Mm. And the only other comparison I can make it is Dr. Sleep and The Shining.
So first of all, before I read this, I think Denis' Blade Runner 2049 is a better film than Sir Ridley Scott's. And I love the first one. I would just rather watch 2049.
What did Ridley say?
This is the headline to the Entertainment Weekly article. Ridley Scott on Blade Runner 2049. Quote, it was fucking way too long. I will continue reading some of his other thoughts.
How long was the last duel again?
yeah. He said this to Vulture. He said, I have to be careful what I say. Then he goes, it was fucking way too long. And then he says, F me. And most of the script's mine. That's what,
so he's having
that
fun. He's saying most of it is
his. Most of that script's mine.
Yeah. He's having fun.
I think he's having fun too.
He's the best.
That's like Tarantino saying he needs to see Tenet again.
Wait, House of Gucci could be over 3 hours from what we're seeing. So who knows? There was like a runtime posted recently.
2049 had a great runtime.
Oh, it's terrific. Audience picks. Randy Buss, a longtime listener of the show. He went with Prisoners. Rahul Ranganath says, impossible to answer, but he went with Incendies. Sebs, Andy Fisher, Danny Thill, and many others went with Blade Runner 2049. Nico, James Vasquez, and many, many, many others went with Arrival. Lots of love for Sicario, Prisoners, and across his entire filmography.
Can we point out how diverse his filmography is?
Oh, yeah. No, it's incredible.
Like, look at Enemy, look at Prisoners, look at Sicario, look at Dune, look at Blade Runner 2049.
Yep.
Like, that's a master.
He's incredible.
That's a master filmmaker.
We're going to keep it in a Halloween theme. And for next week, we're going to play hashtag Final Girl Blend.
Yes.
So
I have my answer. I'm so excited.
And explain
about
what that is, just for people who don't know. Okay.
So normally in a horror slasher movie, there's all the different people who get knocked off during the course of it, and this is usually the last girl standing. It's traditionally a girl. I think we've had some final guys once or twice before, but it's like they have their Langenkamps of the world, who is Nancy in the Freddy Krueger movies. This is the one who survives, and
this is
usually
fun.
Picked up at the end of the movie. And so there's an even really fun comedy, horror comedy, about Final Girls that came
There's
out.
A great book out that I read. The Final right. Girl, Final Girl Support Group or Final, yeah, Final Girls like Support Group. Basically, it's kind of like, it's basically this idea of like, it's almost like an Alcoholics Anonymous, but yeah. if you were a final girl. And it's very, without like, getting to the point where they're crossing into copyright infringement, each final girl they represent is like one of them is the final girl for a white masked killer who stalked babysitters. One of them is the final girl for a killer who was too obsessed with horror films. One of them is the final girl for a killer who wore a skin mask and had a chainsaw. Like,
that's funny.
It's loose enough so that like they can't get sued, right. but enough so you can be like, oh, I know who each one of these are. And it's them in their 50s and 60s and how they're supporting. And then all of a sudden they start getting killed off one by one. It's very
that's
fun.
That's cool.
It's a that's great awesome. Book. It's a very fun read. It's worth your time.
Oh,
that's a
good concept. Has anyone bought the movie rights to that yet? That would be a great movie.
I'm curious as to
with
how...
the actual casting, the actual like final girls from the franchises.
That would be my end game.
Yes,
let's do it. Yes. Let's pool our money together.
So we assume in Halloween Ends that she'll kill Michael Myers, so then Jamie Lee Curtis can join.
Here's
the
all
group
my money. I can provide. <for that. laughs>
Well, she is definitely one of the final girls, without a doubt, just from the first one. So,
just to reiterate something very important. Anybody listening to this podcast, if you have a friend who's really into movies and you feel safe, please go to a theater and see Dune. And we're just saying that because this is a film that we genuinely love.
Yeah.
But it's also a film that we want to see a part to. But we also understand that it might be a film you might be wondering, what is it? I don't know what this is. Or, you know, it is such an experience on the big screen. And I was talking to somebody at work today who was going to watch it on HBO Max. And I was like, I literally will buy your ticket to go to a theater if you go, because it's that important. So if you feel safe, try and bring some friends. That this is a movie that we want to see do well, and we have nothing invested in it. We're just people who love movies. We just want to see it do well because it's so damn good.
Absolutely,
that's all I want to say.
So we'll talk about it next week, how it does. Next premium episode is a mailbag episode.
Mailbag.
Again, you can get access to all that at cinemablend.com/realblendpremium. Follow us online, social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week. E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Last Crusade.
The bad one, Temple of Doom.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.